Hi, David. Thank you for joining me today.
Sure.
What is your earliest memories of baseball? Like, what got you excited about baseball?
My earliest, I got interested in baseball, started getting interested in baseball in the summer of 1944. I was 7 years old. I started by listening to the radio. There was no television, listening to ball games on radio. I went to my first major league game in 1945. Saw the Yankees play the St. Louis Browns. Saw Pete Gray, the one-armed outfielder, playing for the Browns. I grew up in the Highbridge section of the West Bronx in New York City, which meant that I lived within walking distance of both Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds. So getting to major league games was not difficult.
What did baseball statistics mean to you when you were younger?
It was a way of appreciating the games that I didn't see. It made the players come alive. Because with radio, except for the few games I went to, you didn't actually see the players. And I always loved numbers of the arithmetic. I was good at it. So it was just a natural affinity.
Do you remember any particular commentators or writers who wrote about in a baseball statistics in a way that resonated more with you that you would like to follow?
No, not particularly, but I've read, forget exactly when, but not too long after that, I started reading the sporting news pretty regularly. I read Baseball Magazine. 1945, I got my first year, I got annual Who's Who in Baseball. So I did a fair amount of reading of material that had statistics as part of it. I mean, that wasn't just stats, obviously.
So when did you start kind of doing your own work on baseball statistics?
When I was 10, 11 years old, I started playing a board game called Ethan Allen's All-Star Baseball. Ethan Allen, having been a National League outfielder in the 30s, and then for many years, baseball coach at Yale. And after a while, the limitations of that game led me to want something better. Ethan Allen's All-Star Baseball was just hitting. There was no pitching or fielding in the game, which obviously limits it. So what I did when I was 15. I took a deck of poker cards, just 52 cards, and a deck of pinochle cards, which was 48. Put them together, I got 100 cards. I can percentage anything without any difficulty. And I built my own board game, which eventually became the Sports Illustrated Avalon Hill All-Star Baseball Game, or All-Time Baseball Game, I forget what they call But that was the start, my processing my own stats in a way.
So is this a game that ended up being popular that you ended up playing with your friends or?
Yeah, ended up playing with my friends. Started, made it gradually more sophisticated. And then when I was 17, I had a summer job at a summer camp, and I was too young to be a counselor for this particular game. So I was what they called the gate man, this huge camp. Which is like you think of the gate man at a gated community in Florida. I mean, somebody, when people come in, make sure they're allowed in, show them where to park, direct them where to go, et cetera, et cetera. And the person who hired me told me that I would be on duty 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. And he said at least half the time, there'll be absolutely nothing going on and nobody around. So bring stuff to read. Well, I figured out if I brought books, I have to bring a lot of books to read. 8 weeks at 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, you can do a lot of reading. So what I did instead, I bought what I think was the second edition of the Turk and Thompson Baseball Encyclopedia. I took that up with a pad of paper, stuff to write with, and started getting really interested in 19th century Major League Baseball, which I had known nothing about up to that time. And after the summer, when I got back to the city, I went to the New York Public Library, the main branch, the New York Public Library, and discovered that Albert Goodwill Spaulding, the pitcher who became the proprietor and owner of the sporting goods company, had, when he died, willed his library to the New York Public Library. So all the 19th century Spaulding guides were, and I assume still are, at the New York Public Library, the main reference branch. And I started reading more about the 19th century stuff and discovered there was a fair amount in those guides, not the same as there was later on, but a fair amount of stuff. And I just had one of those, you know, random thoughts that people have. Gee, it would be nice someday to do a bigger and better version of Turk and Thompson. And that was the first time that occurred to me.
So when you say bigger and better, what was it lacking? What was it looking like back then, a baseball encyclopedia?
It had very little information about each player. It had who they played for each year, the number of games they played, the positions, and batting average. And I think that was it for batters. Won and lost record for pitchers. I can show you, I have a copy. So by bigger and better, I meant essentially having all the statistics that, let's say, in the guide for that year, you know, at-bats, runs, hits, doubles, triples, home runs, RBIs, walks, strikeouts, stolen bases, you know, batting average, slugging average at that time. And that was it. It was just, at that point, it was just a thought. Nothing to do with reality. In 1965, okay, let me connect here. It doesn't have anything to do with baseball, but I finished my education. I have a BA, MBA, PhD in statistics from Columbia. Spent 2 years in the Army, and then went to work as chief statistician for Lou Harris, the polling company. And then in 1965, was invited to join a small company called Information Concepts Incorporated, which was founded by a guy named Paul Dunkhauser, who had been with IBM and been with Harris, and formed this company. And we started doing some sports stuff. Scoreboards, information panels, promotion thing for IBM, where they had a truck with a computer message board that went around to certain baseball games, some golf tournaments, et cetera. As part of this, I had gone with a coworker of mine, Bill Headline, up to Cooperstown. I'd met Lee Allen, and who was the star in there then, and saw what they had in Cooperstown. Got my first look at baseball's official sheets. Lee had Cy Thompson's index cards of his notes on the demographics about players. Plus he had his own loose leaf notebooks with demographic information. And that was, you know, good to see, interesting. And then the one critical moment, the sort of aha moment, came in either the fall of 66 or the beginning of 67, where Paul Funkhauser, Bill Headline, and I were invited by IBM, the permission of Walter Annenberg, to go to Triangle Publications in Radnor, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. They were installing a new computer system. Main point was that the IBM folks were going to brief the folks at Triangle Publications on their new system, which was going to be used to set type for TV Guide, the magazine, because TV Guide was so successful, it had grown to having a number of regional editions. And the time it took and the cost of setting type, my linotype machine was getting out of hand. So they asked IBM to develop software to do this electronically. And somebody at IBM, I don't know who to credit, made a terrific basic decision, which is not to do one piece of software for a TV Guide, but to two independent pieces of software that could be linked. And one was their standard database software for creating a database and using it. And the second was, which was new, was a formatting program. And what they did was the formatting program, basically, the database program, basically, they assigned a unique number to every TV show, several digit long number. And then so
it's like the key, right? The key value, yeah, in the database.
Yeah. And then they built a little file in the database program. Like today we would call a file folder for each program, and everything about that program went into the file. And then the formatting program could access each of those files and take them out and format that according to how the specific format program was written for TV Guide. And on the way back to New York from Philadelphia, I said to my colleagues, well, let's meet your office tomorrow morning. They went in the following morning and said, look, take everything that we learned yesterday at TV Guide. Only instead of assigning a unique number to every TV show, assign a unique number to every person who ever played Major League Baseball. Combine that with the database. You can set type electronically and do a really big baseball encyclopedia that had not been possible economically before, for us, before the day before.
So let me just understand, because you could put the players in a database, how did that, could you explain how that made an encyclopedia easier to make? Is it just it's easier to update over the years?
The baseball encyclopedia that we published in 1969 has 2,300 pages of six-point type. Imagine what's involved in typesetting those with pieces of lead one at a time and then proofreading every page.
You could avoid the cost of editing and proofreading a baseball encyclopedia if you could get it into electronic.
But the cost of doing it manually, it still costs a lot. It's programming and, you know, data entry and stuff like that. But from a data file standpoint, the beauty of baseball, it's a little less so now because they've changed some of the scoring rules. But then it was a double entry bookkeeping system. The number of hits made by the batters in a year had to equal the number of hits given up by the pitchers and for each team and so on and so forth. So the edit checking of the database could all be done electronically, even with computers in the late 1960s. And we had pages that were printed out of error messages when things didn't add. Went back and figured it out.
So did you design these tests? Were you programming or?
No, I am not a programmer. A wonderful guy named Neil Arman headed up the programming staff, and the programmers did what they had to do and did it spectacularly well.
But were you almost like overseeing it, like coming up with the testing rules and things like that?
Yeah, I was in charge of the project, yeah. The 1969 Baseball Encyclopedia was the first book of any kind published in the United States to be typeset electronically.
You told the story about, hey, let's do what we just saw yesterday at TV Guide. Right. What was the reaction?
Within the company, the reaction was terrific. And we immediately started figuring out how to do it, you know, and doing a budget for it and so on. And then we went to two things. We talked to Major League Baseball about this being official and having their input and working together, and got spectacularly positive reaction. And then we tried to make a deal with a publisher. And we succeeded in making a deal with Macmillan. And then basically Bob Markell, the editor, Macmillan, and I sat down and figured out the precise format to get it manageable. Because my goal initially was to have all the annual stats. And we found out that the amount of space, page space, taken up by fielding wasn't worth it. So the fielding averages did not get into the book.
Do you think that had an impact on baseball statistics in general? It seems like the fielding statistics were overlooked for a long time.
Yeah, because the fielding statistics, until people started really getting into it later on, basically until Sabre, they weren't very useful. And they took up a lot of space.
You were getting interested in the 19th century statistics, right? And you met Lee Allen. How did this all come together for the actual publication? How did you corral all these data sources?
We made Lee an offer for his participation and stuff, and did the same with a guy named John Tattersall, who was a steamship executive in Philadelphia, who had kept scrapbooks with stories and box scores of every National League game in the 19th century, which was very helpful. and et cetera, et cetera. And then, I was head of the project. There were a lot of people working on this. There were more than 30 people working on the project with, and later, some part-timers even more. And we worked out, baseball set up a committee of five people to pass or change the standards, specs for what we were doing. And it was the PR director of the National League, Dave Grody, the PR director of the American League, Bob Holbrook, PR director of MLB, Joe Reichler, Jack Lang, representing the Baseball Writers Association of America, and Lee Allen. And I participated in the meetings, but I was not a voting member of the committee. And we adjudicated everything. I mean, there was several committee meetings. Some of it was done by phone.
By everything, do you mean, say you're trying to determine the official statistic that was valid?
Statistics. There are two parts to the everything. One is what the scoring rules were. So there were several decisions on using the scoring rule the way it was at the time versus using it the way it is now. So for example, the American Association, which was a major league in the 1880s, in 1887, tried to get more publicity for their hitters. They decided to count walks as hits. So committee decided, which I totally agreed with, to change that and make it the way batting averages are compiled at that point, 1968. There were a lot of those kind of decisions. Then there were decisions we passed by the committee, all of the mistakes that we found in the official sheet when we used the software to get these error messages. Some of them were our errors, found those and we fixed them. And some of them were not our errors. They were in the records. So basically that's what the committee did.
So essentially you had game level data, and if it didn't aggregate correctly over the season.
Right. The official sheets are baseball's record for by player for every day of the year. So yes, we had game level records. We had a copy of the official sheets, which started in 1903 in the National League and 1905 in the American League. Before that, we created official sheets, which are now in Cooperstown.
I've heard that part of the research was sending people to city libraries and county graveyards. Could you explain part of the research?
Graveyards, no. Okay. Libraries, yes. Some of the things we take for granted today in baseball statistics don't go all the way back. RBIs were not an official stat till 1920. Earned runs were not an official stat before 1913. So on and so forth. So we did research to fill in those blanks. And some of it involved people going to libraries, depending on what year, what we were looking for, different forms and formats for getting information from the stories of the games.
How did you digitize this information? What was the process like? Once you have it, you've got the official MLB record. They've approved these statistics. How did you end up getting it into a database back in, right, back in those days?
Well, we had, there were forms that the researchers filled in, which were programmed and tied into the database software for key punch back in the world of punch cards.
But you said that there's a lot of things that we take for granted today, statistics, baseball statistics. Do you remember anything about the book that, that you're especially proud that you're able to kind of fill in those gaps?
Yes. The gaps elected two people to the Hall of Fame, Sam Thompson and Addie Joss, because Thompson batted cleanup in Philadelphia from 1891 to 1895. He was a right fielder. The other two outfielders were Billy Hamilton and Ed Delahanty, also Hall of Famers, and they batted ahead of him. And Thompson was an RBI machine. I mean, he basically averaged an RBI a game. And nobody knew it. And Addie Joss wound up being second all-time in lifetime ERA, which nobody knew before the book.
When the book was published, what were the expectations for its sales?
I don't know. We had no idea, except the book, before it was published, gotten a lot of publicity, including for Major League Baseball. I mean, normally, if you have, when a big national publisher like Macmillan published a book, any book, there were basically three levels of things that happened to it from a promotion standpoint. Level one is, they issued two catalogs a year for their salesmen to go around in those days. And the book would get either a half page or a full page in the catalog. That's the lowest level. Level two, they did that. Plus, you would be assigned, the author would be assigned somebody in the publicity department at Macmillan who would then try to arrange some publicity things, you know, radio, bit of TV, bit, whatever, but not a lot of time. And there would be a launch party, which was always lunch, at a restaurant with the press invited. And the editor of the book would hold up a copy for photographs and say what a great book it was. Level two is the same as level one with two differences. One difference is that when you were assigned a publicity person to work on the book, that person spent a lot of their time working on this book. Probably, let's say, at least a day a week for a couple of months. And at the lunch, the person who held up the book wasn't the editor, it was the president of the publishing company. Our launch party, first of all, Macmillan didn't assign somebody in the promotion department. They had hired an outside PR company to do it. Secondly, the person who held up the book for the photographs was the commissioner of baseball, Louis Kuhl. It was different. I mean, every newspaper that ever ran a book review reviewed this book. I did 5 minutes with Joe Garagiola on Today's Show, which was then the biggest thing on television, or close to it. All kinds of things happened.
What surprised you about the, I would say, like the fan reception of the book?
I don't remember being surprised by it. I mean, I knew what we had because of baseball's reaction. And one of the things about the sales of the book is, it was sold, there were a lot of what publishers call special sales. Horace Stoneham, who's the owner of the Giants there, still alive, bought, I don't remember, a few thousand copies to give to season ticket holders as a Christmas present. The Griffith family, Minnesota Twins, had recently moved to Minnesota. And they were having trouble kind of getting positive reaction from the people in Minnesota. So Calvin Griffith bought a special, this I'll come back to the special edition in a minute, and donated them to public libraries across the state of Minnesota. One of the things McMillan did turned out to be very important for what I just said. Great production director named Abel Erman decided to make this one volume, but in a slipcase. And the wonder of that is normally if you were going to do a special sale to the Minnesota Twins, the Minnesota Twins want their cover on the book. But with this book, you never had to change the cover. Just do a new cardboard slipcase, which is relatively easy and inexpensive, that says, given to the library courtesy of the Minnesota Twins. So we had a big special sale to Sears, which basically didn't sell books then or now. They sold books. It was all over the place. So you not only had the traditional bookstores, you had special sales. You had libraries. You know, sooner or later, every huge number of libraries bought the book. It was truly an encyclopedia of a specialized subject, but it met at least my colloquial definition of the word encyclopedia.
Sabre was founded, you know, 2 years after it was printed. When did you get involved with Sabre?
I was not involved in the forming. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. But I love the idea, still do. And I think I'm member 28 or something like that. So I joined it very early.
Did you see the impact of the book on Sabre firsthand?
Oh, sure. I mean, some of the people who founded it had made contributions to the book, what we were doing. I mean, people like Bob Davids, for example, was one of the founders of Sabre. And I think one or two of the people who founded it had actually worked on the book. All of a sudden, the book did two things. It freed up the notion that with computers, you could do a lot with baseball research. And the second notion was that there's still stuff to do, that we never, and it says in the book, appendix to the book. This is not, you know, the end of the trail, so to speak. This is just, this is a dynamic situation. And people are going to find things and change things and add things, hopefully, forever.
You need good data in order to build accurate models, right? And take actions that are more optimized. And if the data is missing or incomplete, you don't have the full story.
Right.
You ended up leaving ICI.
Yes, 1971, summer of 71.
After completing this enormous project, how did the next project come to mind?
It partially existed already because I went from ICI to SI, to Sports Illustrated, and with my baseball game that I had created some years earlier. and a plan to create board games for other sports, which we did. And they had an organization called Sports Illustrated Enterprises, which at that point sold books, some books, SI books, through Lippincott, the publisher, and posters of athletes. And they put the games in this unit, and I became general manager of Sports Illustrated Enterprises. And these products were sold through stores and through house ads, mail order in SI. And what happened was, while I was there during the time, during the 2.5 years I was at SI, the magazine went from being okay financially to being spectacularly successful, which destroyed the business plan of SI Enterprises, because we no longer had the quantity of house space ads in the magazine. But it was great fun for a while.
So after the board games, I guess you decided to do the sports encyclopedia.
Right. When I signed on at SI, I offered to take with me three of the guys who had worked on the baseball encyclopedia at ICF: Jordan Deutsch, Dick Cohen, and Roland Johnson. And they accepted. And then when the SI thing ended, the four of us formed a little company called Sports Products Incorporated. And we made a deal with SI. Very nice. They were very nice about it because they recognized it wasn't our fault. We agreed to continue to sell the games direct mail, producer direct mail. And in return for that, they gave us the mailing list that we had used at SI. So we started with that. So then when we went to make a deal for the paperback books, our editor, McMillan, Bob Markell, had become an editor at Grosset & Dunlop. And we went to him, and we had some clout because, first of all, he knew us from the encyclopedia. And secondly, we were going to buy a certain number of copies so that we could sell direct mail, help sell the project. So we made a deal. And then my deal with the new company was, I said, I think it was a year. I said I would work full time with the new company for a year, see how it did. But after that, I reserved the right to go do it part time and do something else to make sure I could support my family.
How was the sports encyclopedia different than the official encyclopedia of baseball?
Smaller, cheaper. In the 1969 baseball encyclopedia had a list price of $25, which in 1969 was a big ticket item. The idea behind the paperback version, not version, different book, was A, that it was cheaper. B, it was organized year by year with text for every year. Jordan's a writer, which would give a decent perspective, a different perspective. It was easier in the McMillan book. The strength of the book was being able to look up a player. The strength of the paperback book was being able to look up a year or a team for a year and see how their stats were and how they were put together. And it worked. I mean, the Sports Encyclopedia of Baseball had 26 editions from the early 70s, guess 1973 was the first, and 2007 was the last. Not every year, but close. So it did well.
Were you involved updating it every year?
Yes, but only involved with the, only involved on the content side. Dick Cohen was full-time SBR the rest of his life, ran the mail order and direct mail business, and also did a lot of work on the production.
I guess in a way, the official Encyclopedia Baseball became the official statistics of Major League Baseball, right?
Yes, until then they started fooling with it and changing some of the grades when, after I left ICI. So different, anyway, that's a whole other world.
But essentially that became the database that fans were using going forward.
Yes.
And I guess one of the reasons why Sean wanted me to talk to you is because it, you know, it eventually became the database, you know, it was part of the database that is Baseball Reference or MLB.com or.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
What did you, you went through this kind of process of recreating from the historical archive what the statistics should be, almost like going to the primary sources.
Right.
What was your reaction to seeing kind of the internet baseball databases and the more advanced statistics that came out derived from, you know, this original primary data? Did you see that coming after the encyclopedia eventually, not the internet, but just more advanced analytics coming? Or
oh yeah,
is that a surprise?
In fact, when I started the Sports Encyclopedia Baseball, you know, only 5 years basically after McMillan, I tried very hard to fool with the format to include on-base average because I knew about it. I mean, people in baseball knew about on-base average. I mean, Al Roth did it with the Dodgers in the mid-40s, in 1946. We all knew that this was a good thing, but I couldn't squeeze the format anymore to get it in. So eventually it never got in. But no, I'm a big fan of Baseball Reference. I love it. I love what people are doing. I agree with probably 80% of it. And some of it I don't. There are some things, for example, I mean, WHIP, you know, WHIP, the pitchers, doesn't make a lot of sense because pitchers pitch to batters in sequence. It's not that they come up four times a game in different innings. So I'll give you two left-handed pitchers. Look at Tom Glavine. Look at Sid Fernandez, very similar whip. Tom Glavine was a master at pitching with people on base. He didn't give a hoot if there were guys on base. He could handle it. Sid Fernandez would many times have one blow-up inning in the game, allow a disproportionate number of his hits and walks in one inning. And people who talk about evaluating pitchers using WHIP to a great extent, I think it's a huge mistake. It, not only in practice, but in theory, because you're pitching to the next batter. Anyway, so I don't agree with that. I know how hard it is to do fielding. Some of the stuff they did, some of the fielding stuff that has gone into the WAR calculations. Really good stuff.
Is there anything you think fans should embrace when you think of data and statistics? It's almost like fans could be a very big critic to a manager that ends up using analytics and statistics and data. Or do you feel that the fans over the years have essentially gotten smarter with data and statistics?
I think a lot of them gotten smarter. Yeah. You never get 100%, obviously. And you have to have a sense of the limitation of the statistics. I don't agree with taking out a starting pitcher just on the basis of the stats. Because pitchers, there will be times when pitchers, to a statistician, you have to balance off the type one extremes versus the type two extremes. So managers know that they can see many times, and it's evident in the score, that a starting pitcher is having a really bad day, and they know to get him out of it. But with modern statistics, they don't always do the same thing on the other side when he's having a really good day. I'm not saying you let him go to 150 pitches, but you should let him go a little longer, go to the bell curve, see what the stretch is at the upper end. You're very smart looking at the stretch at the lower end when he's doing poorly. Look at the upper end stretch when he's on a roll. So manager has to be able to combine both.
Yeah, I don't know, especially during this time, I don't know how well people are. I feel like people don't appreciate the bell curve as much as they should.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes. We look at statistics as a number, not as the top of a bell curve with deviation.
Yeah, an expectation, right? It's an expectation that has a deviation, and it's right. Perfectly normal that good things can happen too, right? So, well, David, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
It's just amazing all the work you put in so that we could have baseball statistics that we just can now look up around the world at any time. But without all that hard work, it wouldn't have been possible.
Thank you.